overseas. And was funded from overseas.
Do you see it as being, the funding I'd like to know about, do you see it as being a movement that was generated by corporations who use leftists, or do you see it as being a genuinely leftist movement, or a movement that was encouraged by certain governments? I mean, how would you frame the authorship?
Well, there was a small but vociferous leftist movement in South Africa centered around the four English language universities, the white, what used to be the white English language universities, and one of which I attended, the University of Witwatersrand in Johannesburg.
Yes.
But all of the media, the state media, the mainstream newspapers, and so on, supported the old government. So it was really just at the universities that you had this movement, and then the foreign governments and their embassies in South Africa, they started to undermine, they were actually interfering in South Africa's internal affairs because they were actually funding dissident and revolutionary groups. And of course, the Swedish government donated every year a huge amount of money. Some people say it was up to $100 million per annum to the ANC. They actually voted that money in parliament in Sweden that went straight to the ANC. And you can actually read up on this stuff on the internet nowadays, because the people who were involved in it are now boasting about it. In fact, the current Swedish, or the previous Swedish ambassador who was in South Africa, was ambassador in 2004. On the 27th of April 2004, he stated on the radio here that without Sweden, the ANC would never have come to power. I was quite amazed by that statement, and I thought there would be some repercussions in the press and so on.
And he was an ethnic Swede?
Yes. He was an ethnic Swede, and he stated that on the radio. And the Swedish money, and also money from the UN, was channeled to Switzerland, and from there to three legal firms in London, who then disbursed all of this money to South Africa to be used to foment unrest and riots and insurrection against, the previous South African government. But in fact, if you look at it, probably about half of all black people in South Africa also supported the old government, and the system, the old homeland system that they created here. So the whole thing was really driven from outside. South Africa itself would never have gone through this process of revolution or transformation or whatever you might want to call it now without foreign interference.
Yes, I remember quite well that Barclays came under a lot of pressure from the left, who acted in concert against them, naming them and shaming them for supporting the South African economy and therefore the National Party, and going after large companies who were banking with Barclays getting them that way. It was very well organized.
It was, but there was one person, and if you think that, one often hears about the one person being able to change history. And that person in our case was Trevor Huddleston, who was the Bishop Trevor Huddleston of the Anglican Church in South Africa.
Yeah.
I read up quite a lot on him a while ago, and he had an amazing obsession with South Africa. He spent some time here from about 1945 to 1940, to the late 50s. And after that, he dedicated his whole life to bringing the ANC to power. In fact, to a large extent, he'd actually created people like Tutu and Mandela. Tutu was only a boy of about 14 when Huddleston took him under his wing, gave him certain books to read, and so on, and started influencing him. In fact, Huddleston organized the first black protest meeting in South Africa in about 1950, shortly after the National Party had come to power.
Yes.
And he put Mandela, he wanted to get a black person to put on the stage next to him, and then he discovered Mandela, who was the first black lawyer in Johannesburg. And from there onwards, then he organized the money as well. In fact, it was through him and another Swedish journalist, somebody called Per Westberg, who today serves on the Nobel Prize Committee designating the annual Nobel Prize for Literature. And he was a personal friend of Olof Palme, who became the Swedish Prime Minister in the early 70s. And from there on, you know, the money started flowing to the ANC. So it was a very small group of people, and the one person in particular, Trevor Huddleston, who was the author of this revolution that we are going through at the moment. So, you know, there's one English priest actually led to our downfall, as it were.
No white person has done more for South Africa than Trevor Huddleston, Nelson Mandela. That's on a bust.
And there's another quote, you know, you can go onto the ANC's website called anc.org.za, I think, and there's actually a short autobiography by Trevor Huddleston on it, and right at the beginning, there's a quote from Desmond Tutu where he states that if there is one person who made apartheid a world issue, it was Trevor Huddleston. In fact, he was instrumental also in getting financial sanctions voted against South Africa in 1986 by influencing three Commonwealth observers who came to South Africa, and he personally went to see them and persuaded them that it was a good idea and that it was actually it would be accepted by some of the Western countries to impose financial sanctions against South Africa. So he played a unique role, and to some extent, I'm also inspired by him, because if he could have that much influence, global influence on one country, then surely one person can also do the opposite and perhaps then liberate South Africa from the current yoke of oppression that we are suffering. You know, and you just go about applying certain principles that he applies.
Let's talk about that issue. For one person to decide to destroy an established way of life, to do that, it has to have a good deal of support, which he had. For you to do something like that, or for another South African to do something like that in reverse, would require a great deal of support from other Afrikaners and from other white South Africans. So, I mean, how do Afrikaners feel at the moment about the situation? Do they want to see change, or are they going to accept it?
Well, ironically, at the moment, they, you know, in the elections, they do vote for the so-called main opposition party here, which is the Democratic Alliance, which is a run by a group of liberals who didn't used to have any real support in South Africa in the old days. I mean, they got about 5 or 6 seats in the old parliament, but nowadays they are the main opposition party. But I think they vote for them simply because they don't see anybody else on the horizon. And of course, half of them don't even vote because they consider it to be completely futile. Mm-hmm. But they are, you know, when you speak to people, and even, I mean, they write it in the Afrikaans newspapers these days as well, that there definitely is a huge sense of frustration and anger at the current system. Right. So I think things are, possibly to use a cliche, things are hotting up in South Africa, and I think sooner or later there will be some form of resistance from Afrikaners, whether it will be violent or non-violent, or whether it will be simply intellectual or ideological, I don't know. But, I mean, there will definitely be
something. You think something's going to happen?
I think so, yes.
That's encouraging. Ideally, of course, it would either be some form of segregation and self-government, or a decision to get the hell out of a dead-end situation through
migration,
mass migration.
Yes. Exactly.
It's got to go one way or the other, hasn't it?
Yes. We only have three real options. The one would be what's actually happening at the moment, and up to now, over a million people have actually individually emigrated to other countries, mainly English-speaking countries like Australia, New Zealand, UK,
I don't like
Canada.
That very much, because I don't think that you can, over two generations, I don't think that you can really retain sufficient of the meaning of what that people are. I think that it's a kind of death, and it is
exactly.
It is the second solution.
Well, exactly. You know, the children in those countries, they are surrounded by another culture. Even in Canada, which is supposedly a bilingual country, French-speaking Canadians outside Quebec don't actually manage to transmit their language to their children. So it's completely impossible for someone who emigrates from here to go to Australia. I mean, only a very small percentage of people will be able to transmit their own language and culture to their children. Incidentally, there was a radio journalist from here who spent 25 years in Italy. And she had a son there, and he was 25 years old when he came back to South Africa and spoke fluent Afrikaans.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's an exception. Right. Mm. Normally you don't find that. So, yes, it is a tragedy. I mean, this immigration at the moment is an absolute tragedy, because we are slowly, you know, our nation is being eroded, and we are, I mean, for a start, we are demographically at a disadvantage to black South Africans, who are more numerous, who have had higher birth rates for over a century than we do.
There's about 40 million of them, isn't there? There's about 40 million black Africans.
Yes.
And there's about
But about 10 to 15 million of those are actually illegal immigrants. So, you know, we've got the different demographic disadvantage simply growing all the time as a result of legal immigration as well. Because, you know, AIDS has put a significant brake on black demography in South Africa. You know, you had a miraculous doubling of the black population here every 20 to 25 years, you know, from 1950 onwards. And you no longer see that, because there's all sorts of skullduggery around AIDS statistics, but it definitely has curtailed this tremendous and explosive population growth that we've seen in this country. But now we've got, of course, the immigration problem coming to the fore very much. And that's also going to cause, and it's already causing, ethnic conflict in South Africa. You know, last year we had almost 100 people killed in so-called black-on-black violence.
Right, this was the Zimbabweans who were attacked in Soweto,
yeah, not only Zimbabweans, but also Malawians, you know, the Somalis, people from all over Africa who, you know, drift to South Africa. And, and about 80 of them were killed, and not one person was charged with a crime. You know, the government simply, there was a sort of an outcry about these attacks, which they called xenophobic attacks, but no one was actually charged with a crime for doing that.
So let's talk about the instincts of the Afrikaners again. I mean, I'm quite intrigued by the idea that there's this great anger, and normally when you put a lid on the kettle for too long, something's going to happen. There's going to be some steam coming up. So that's good. Do Afrikaners understand that they have to segregate, they've got to do this if they want to live, or do they believe, by and large, that they can reform the system from within? What's the general balance of opinion?
Yes. Traditionally we have been very pragmatic. We've had to survive in Africa where, you know, when we came over the mountains in the 19th century, there was absolutely nothing. There was just the African bush. And under those conditions, you have to be pragmatic to survive. But that's also becoming a problem, because we don't act in a principled enough way to ensure our long-term survival at present. But I would say that the notion, you see, in 1994, the Freedom Front, this political party striving for self-determination, and got about 500,000 votes. But in 1999, when the big swing to the Liberal Party, to the DA, came about, they lost a lot of those votes. And since then, the notion of what's called a folk state, or a nation state, or a people state, has been stigmatized by especially the mainstream media in South Africa. But that idea is now slowly
gaining
ground. And if you look especially at the sort of comments that people leave on blogs and on the commentary sections of the newspapers, on the internet and so on, people are now quite open about it, and they say the only thing that is going to save us is a territory of our own and a state of our own. So we were talking about the options left to us. The one would be individual immigration and being assimilated by Australia, UK, US and so on.
Not ideal, but at least
second
it's
one would be a mass exodus. And, you know, so I actually, at the beginning of the year, I wrote a kind of a jocular letter on a website where I, because I'd just spoken to a German journalist who told me that parts of northeastern Germany are actually becoming depopulated because of the lack of economic activity there. And he said in a kind of a, well, it wasn't entirely serious, but he told me, you know, why don't you go to the German embassy, tell them that you'd like to all immigrate to northeastern Germany and occupy one of the länder in the old East Germany. And, you know, I started reading up a little bit on those parts. But when you mentioned this idea to people that all of us could just pack up and go and occupy some part of Europe, you know, they get very excited about that. You know, all the people around you talk to about that. And also, after writing that little piece, a lot of people contacted me about that and told me, you know, if ever this thing becomes a reality, please contact me. You know, so,
well, I'll tell you now, the only way it can become a reality is if Europeans decide that they want to live among themselves and to expel all those who are not European from their societies. Well, in that event, in that great event, should that ever happen, and I'm wholly in favour of that, then there would indeed be large areas of land and large population movements of Europeans back to Europe would be wholly efficacious. And I should think you'd be able to pick your spot on the Dutch-Belgian border and say, that'll do nicely, you know, and go back to where your forefathers came from.
That's true. But of course, you know, looking, you know, some people predict that within 20 years, Holland will be a Muslim country.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I think that there's going to be a lot of things that will happen over the next 20 years. But that's our problem in Europe, and I don't want to waste this interview on all that stuff. So the third option is retiring to the kraal somewhere. You know, Orania is the place which is most often spoken about, and there is another one, I think, near Pretoria.
Kleinland,
that's it, yep.
In my view, we deserve a much bigger part of the country, including some of the, you know, infrastructure around the economic heartland of the country. And there was a very interesting book published, you know, around about 1990 by an engineer, a Dr. Willem van Leeuwen, and he did a whole study on the issue. And he identified two or three areas in the country where there was a potential white and Afrikaner majority, and also enough resources in the form of coal and power stations, water, and so on for us to be able to prosper economically. And, you know, I still believe that his study of this whole issue has been the best one to date, and there's a lot to learn from that. And I personally believe that we should look at, you know, gaining one or two of those territories earmarked by him in the book, which would include large parts of Pretoria. Still the very largest white grouping or population in this country is to be found in the vicinity of Pretoria and stretching to the east and south-east of Pretoria. So, you know, there are about a million white people living there. And I think that's a natural core for any future nation state demanded by Afrikaners in this country. And that's also where historically, you know, we've got...
But demanded of whom? Because nothing's going to be granted to you.